Sure. And what I thought I would do this afternoon, we're a little bit ahead in our lab, in our lab schedule. The way that it normally works is we usually have lab for 2 or 3 days for each one of our labs, and they're all blocked out. And we normally, within the semester, never get to the last lab because we usually fall behind. It takes us some extra days to get some of our melting points done and to get some of our spectroscopy done, some of our FTIR. And so we never generally even make it to the oxidation reduction scheme, which is a great lab and a fun lab to do. But given the constraints that we have of being online, we're ahead of schedule, amazingly. So we've got 2 weeks left, and I can present that oxidation reduction scheme in just a day or two. And so what I thought I would do is take this afternoon and do something a little bit different. The idea is that we never really get to look at the context of what it is that we're trying to do with organic chemistry. We spend so much time focused on our individual reactions and individual reaction mechanisms and the context of the lab itself and the skill sets within the lab that we never get to talk about what sort of is the bigger picture with organic chemistry. What can we do with organic chemistry? And so in light of current events, there's a new medication that has just been approved, an emergency situation. Sorry, there goes my dogs. Give them a second to stop barking. They've approved a new medication for people who have COVID-19. I'm going to close my door. I'll help quiet them down a little bit. Or at least make it so we don't hear them as much. And that new medication is called remdesivir. And remdesivir is a fairly large molecule. And so what I thought I would do is take a look at that large molecule and look at the synthesis of it and what it does, where it comes from, and how hard it is to synthesize, and relate it back to things that we're doing in the lecture as well along the way, and sort of give us the bigger picture. And this will allow us to talk about a number of different things. It'll allow us to talk about the reactions that we're doing in context. It'll allow us to bring in the idea of synthesis, which is something that we do in large part second semester. So second semester, we spend a lot of time on synthesis and an idea or concept of what is called retrosynthetic analysis, which is taking a molecule that you want to build and working backwards to figure out how you're going to build it, tearing it apart by doing what are called bond disconnections and functional group transformations to come up with a set of reactions to rebuild a molecule or to build a molecule from scratch. So that's another idea. And the other concept is in second semester with special projects, we look at doing synthesis and isolation and a lot of different things. And so in the context of second semester organic lab, this is not the type of thing that we would tackle in its entirety, but we might approve doing 2 or 3 out of the steps of this synthesis from the beginning of the synthesis and looking at that. So it allows us to talk about a lot of different types of things. And so let's start off and let me show you what the molecule looks like. And we'll go and I've got some pre-drawn notes that I've already made and some things that I want to pull out. So let's start with the molecule here. That's right, and I got a fast switcher. I don't know if that's gonna work for me. Nope, and I lost my new note. So we'll start a new note here and we'll just put this in. Okay, so this is remdesivir. And remdesivir is an active molecule that binds to the RNA. This is the viral RNA, what was it? It was a, it's not a protease. It's It's a enzyme that works, that is specific to the virus, that does replication of the viral mRNA. And remdesivir, and particularly this last portion of the molecule over here, binds to that enzyme that allows for the replication of the viral RNA and blocks it and prohibits it. Oh, screen share. I'm not screen sharing, Matt. Thank you. Okay. I thought I was screen sharing. Let me see what's wrong. Something's wrong. So I'm going to stop the sharing there and try to initiate it again. I found that they... Oh, that's what happened. Okay. All right, Matt. Thank you for that timely intervention there. That helps. Okay. So what we're talking about is this is remdesivir, and it's a fairly large molecule. And you can see that it's got a good number of stereocenters within this molecule. And the end portion of the molecule over here is the part that that binds to the viral RNA reproduction enzyme. And it is meant to look like a sugar and a base pair on there. And that's done intentionally so that this can bind irreversibly in the place of what would normally be the sugar and the base pair that would bind there. And it does so in such a way that it completely blocks and prohibits the enzyme from working so that the virus cannot rebuild its viral RNA. And it also escapes some of the mechanisms that the virus has for when those enzymes break down to rebuilding those enzymes. This binds irreversibly so that it can't fix that either. So, and the rest of the part of the molecule, the left-hand side of the molecule, is meant to be a delivery mode for the active part. And this part here that has the phosphate, you can think of this as a phosphate, sugar, and the amino base that is just like you would have in an RNA or a DNA. And in fact, this is looking like ribose, which is in RNA. So this is a ribose sugar derivative. And it's done in purpose in order, and you can see it also has sort of an amino acid component that's over here. So we have the amino acid bound to the phosphate, bound to the sugar and the base. And all of that is meant to mimic the backbone of the RNA molecule, such that when this does bind to the enzyme and the enzyme picks this up, just like this was part of the viral RNA, then it binds into that binding pocket and it doesn't let go and it just shuts down that enzyme, and that enzyme can no longer reproduce the viral RNA. And it's specific to the viral RNA enzyme and does not inhibit any enzymes within humans. So our RNA and DNA polymerases are different than the viral polymerases, and this only binds selectively to the viral polymerase, which is really kind of cool. So that's a little bit about what the drug does and why the drug has the structure it has. Now what we need to do is we need to sort of break this molecule apart and then take a look at the synthesis and how they're going to put this back together. Because you have to realize and think about the fact that this is the first therapeutic that we have that has shown any activity against the virus. And they're going to try to reproduce this, not just for people in the United States, but for people all over the world. And so how do you synthesize a molecule as complicated as this with six stereocenters? And it has to be a single isomer. So this is not racemic in any way. This is single isomer. And as a single isomer, we could go through and we can assign all the stereocenters in this, but it's got six different stereocenters. And so if we pull it up, you can see the six different stereocenters there. And so we've got 1, 2, 3, 4. The phosphorus is a stereocenter, that's 5 and 6. Fortunately, these are not so difficult to put together, although some of them are a bit tricky. But because we're basing this on a sugar, and so we've got sort of a ribose sugar backbone that's here, several of these stereocenters are already set by the ribose sugar itself. And similarly, the alanine that is over here, that is the amino acid, the alanine stereocenter is set for us. So those stereocenters aren't that difficult. What are difficult is the stereocenters that are the phosphate stereocenter. That one's really challenging. And the stereocenter that has the cyano group on it, that one is also really challenging. So those are the two main stereocenters that we've got to deal with. And the rest of it comes together fairly easily. Okay, so in breaking this down, what we're going to do is look at the natural places where we would break bonds. So if we think about the sugar itself and we isolate the sugar and we say, okay, this bond here to the amine base, that bond is going to have to come off. And the cyano group here, we're going to have to put the cyano group on as well. The phosphate, that bond is going to be cleaved, and everything that is attached to the phosphorus is going to come off and is going to be reconstructed from a phosphate. And also this ester bond that is here with this alanine, those are all components that we are going to have to put together. And so if we take this and look at it from a perspective where I've got it colored out, here we can kind of break down each one of those groups into colors. And so we can see where the sugar matches up. So let's style that with that dark blue. We can match the phosphate in red. We can match the phenol in green. I think that was a dark green. We've got the amino acid, which is based on alanine. We'll style that in blue. And then finally, this alcohol portion over here, which we'll style in orange. So there are all the components that are going to go into this. And we're going to look at the chemistry that puts this all back together. How do we put these molecules together? And there are several different ways that synthesis is done. In one way, when we do a synthesis, we do a linear synthesis. And we take A, and we convert A into B, and we convert B into C, and C into D, and D into E. And for many drugs, this could be as many as 6, 7, 8 steps, or sometimes in a very complicated drug, it can be 25, 27 steps. I think one of the most fundamentally important cancer drugs was Taxol, and I think Taxol was 27 steps, 27 sequential steps. And when you have steps like this in a linear reaction, the percent yield that you get overall, each one of these reactions goes in a particular percent yield. And so we would have percent of reaction one. Percent one. And percent two, and percent three, and percent four. The overall yield out of a linear sequence like this is the decimal equivalent of each one of these percentages multiplied by each other. So we would take percent one and multiply it by percent two, and percent three, and percent four, and multiply them all out as their decimal equivalent, and then multiply by 100, and that is the overall percent for the overall reaction. And those yields can be fairly low when they're in a linear sequence like that. It can be difficult in order to, let's just say, for example, let's say that each one of these was a 90% yield. That's 1, 2, 3, 4 different reactions at 90% yield. So what I would have is I would have just if 90% each. That would give me 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9 times 100. Or that's 0.9 to the fourth times 100. What does that come out to? Let's just check it. 0.9 to the fourth times 100. That's only 65%, 65.61% overall yield. And a 90% yield is pretty damn good in terms of a chemical reaction. But even just in four chemical steps, I'm already down to 65% on the overall drug, which makes the drug more expensive to synthesize. And think about if that was 27 steps. If you had 27 steps and each reaction was 0.9% or 90%, 0.9 to, I don't know, let's do it 26. That's 6%. So 27 steps at 90% yield for every step would only give you 6% yield, which I think is pretty much what Taxol is about a 6% isolated yield after 27 steps, which is pretty amazing. So the other way to do this is to do what's called a convergent synthesis. And in a convergent synthesis, what we do is we take A and react it to make B and react it to make C and then D. And in another pathway, we're doing E to F to G to H. And then we take and we combine D and H to make I. And what this does is it makes it such that if I have a low yielding step in one place, it doesn't knock down the overall reaction percent yield as much. So this is called a convergent synthesis. And convergent synthesis have many advantages over linear synthesis. They allow us to take each one of the parts and build each part and then combine the big parts into the overall drug and do it more efficiently with less loss, just in the way that, and I don't have an example here to show you how the percent yield is calculated, but we could look at it and we could say, all right, if we had a 0.90, that D would be 0.9 to the third times 100. And so 0.9 to the third times 100, this is going to be like a 72% yield. I'd get a 72% yield down here. And then when I combine those together, if that goes in at 90%, I don't know how I calculate that. I need to think about that and how I actually bring those together into what the overall yield is. But I wind up with a better overall yield than if I had done six steps at 90% overall. It just comes out more efficiently. And I apologize, I don't have the math at the tip of my tongue there in order to show you exactly how that works. But that's the power of convergent synthesis, is that it allows you to do it more efficiently. And then it becomes more economically viable. So that's one of the catchphrases that we do, is it economically viable? And economically viable has a number of different meanings to it. So when we want a drug to be economically viable, we want to have a low cost of synthesis. So that means that we like to do things at room temperature instead of hot or cold. Both things, if we're doing super hot temperatures or super cold temperatures, that requires a lot of energy. The more energy, the more cost it is in making the drug. So we like to do reactions at room temperature instead of hot or cold. We like to do things at atmospheric pressure or in air. So we like to do reactions that are in air instead of inert atmosphere, like nitrogen or argon. Those types of conditions where we have to do things that are air-free cost more money to be able to manage. The other thing is the percent yield. We want the percent yield to be high. We like to do things that are called stereoselective. So we want a stereo selective reaction, meaning that we're producing a single isomer instead of having to do some type of resolution. When you do a stereoselective reaction, what we're doing is we're getting 100% single isomer or high percentage single isomer. When we do a resolution, we throw 50% of the thing that we made away. Which makes it much more expensive. So all of these concepts go into the idea of what makes a reaction commercially viable. So as we go through this reaction synthesis, I'll mention some of these things and we'll talk about some of these things for each one of the reactions in context. Okay. Sound like a good idea? Does this sound of interest in terms of looking at how something this big is made and doing it in context? And cool. Okay. So I think this has value in that it allows us to talk about the types of things that we can do second semester as well. And you'll see that some of these reactions that we're looking at are SN2 reactions that we've been studying. And as we go through second semester, we will study many of the different types of reactions that we're going to study in here. It involves carbohydrate chemistry. It involves reactions at carbonyls. It involves SN2 reactions. It involves protection and deprotection steps that need to happen within a synthesis. So sometimes when you have a molecule that is as complicated as remdesivir, you can't do a linear sequence because many of your functional groups would be destroyed by later on reactions. And so what we have to do is we have to put protecting groups to mask certain types of functional groups so that they don't get harmed and that we only react at a specific site within the molecule. And then we remove those protecting groups, which costs us extra steps so that it is more steps to make the molecule, but you couldn't do it without those sorts of protecting groups and deprotecting strategies. So that's another whole thing that we cover in second semester as well, which is looking at when do we need to protect a functional group and how do we protect it and how do we remove it? And that all flows into the sequence of chemical reactions of how do I choose which reaction to do first, second, third, fourth, fifth. Okay, so all of that is all wrapped up into this synthesis of remdesivir. And Nicole, what determines if a synthesis has to be performed in something other than air? Ooh, great question too. Some reactions require extraordinarily strong bases or acids, or water will mess up the chemical reactions. And so some reagents, things like tertiary butyl lithium, if I take and look at this reaction, which is called tertiary butyl lithium, this is an extraordinarily dangerous reagent. And if it reaches any sort of water, it pulls the proton from the water molecule and does so. The lithium is the counter ion, and we always draw it with the bond here, but the bond is really really not a covalent bond. It's an ionic bond, and it will pull the proton, and when it pulls the proton, it produces this guy plus hydroxide. But then as soon as this gets formed, it also produces a tremendous amount of heat, and the whole thing explodes, and it explodes in a green fireball as soon as it gets any water. So that when you have it in a syringe, and the syringe at the tip is exposed to air at the tip, you'll see smoke and sometimes a little bit of flame coming off the tip of the syringe when it is exposed to air. And you have to immediately get it into from one container to the next container without exposing it to air so that the entire contents doesn't explode. It's a little bit dangerous to handle. And there have been people that have died by handling tertiary butyl lithium. And so in this synthesis, they use N-butyl lithium, which is not as dangerous and something that I allow students to actually use in second semester. We have done many different synthesis with N-butyl lithium, but N-butyl lithium is not as dangerous as tertiary butyl lithium. N-butyl lithium has the anion here and the lithium reagent it's a primary carbanion, whereas the other one is a tertiary carbanion. The tertiary carbanion is so much stronger than the primary carbanion that it just spontaneously explodes. If you were to drop the bottle, you couldn't run fast enough. When the bottle hit the ground, it would just explode in a green fireball. The N-butyl lithium will smoke before it catches fire and gives you a good bit of reaction time. But many different reactions need to be in an inert atmosphere to control their reactivity and to prevent water from destroying one or more of the reagents or interfering with the reaction itself. So sometimes it's something like this, which is what is called pyrophoric, in which case we have to eliminate water. Or sometimes it's just because water messes with the reaction and therefore we do it in an inert atmosphere to keep everything dry. Okay, let's start off with the synthesis and show kind of how this thing gets put together. So let me get N-butyl lithium out of here. And I think what I want to do is take from some of these reactions. And we'll chunk them out this way. Okay, in the first reaction, what we're doing is we're combining L-alanine with a phosphorus reagent. And both of these would have to be synthesized. Let's see, Maddie, sorry. Are third degree carbanions less stable than first? Ooh. Okay, backing up a second. When you look at a carbanion, carbanions are tetrahedral. And so when we look at a primary carbanion, what we have is two hydrogens on the terminal end and the anion, which occupies the p orbital. And remember that lone pairs of electrons exert a larger force than do other atoms, such that when you look at a nitrogen with a lone pair on the nitrogen, which this is kind of like, that the bond angle down here is not 109.5, that the bond angle down there is closer to 103, because the lone pair exerts a larger downwards force, a repulsive force, than do the other atoms like hydrogen. Okay, so the bond angle here similarly is somewhere around 103. But as we go to the tertiary carbanion where there are methyl groups, now that carbanion has CH3 groups here, and each of these CH3 groups are tetrahedral. And so there's a lot of sterics by trying to cram these guys down together. Because it's not 109.5, there's a lot of steric, what is called backstrain. Backstrain is looking at the sterics involved in the groups that are attached to the carbanion or other group that is creating the backstrain. And the backstrain makes this higher in energy and less stable than a primary carbanion. So yes, a third degree carbanion is less stable than a first degree carbanion. Not for electronic reasons, but for steric reasons. So in electronic reasons, usually we think that the alkyl groups are electron donating, and for carbocations, tertiary carbocations are way more stable than primary carbocations. For carbanions, it's the reverse. Tertiaries are less stable, much less stable than our primary. So yeah, good question. And it comes from the sterics more than the electronics. Okay, we ready to go now? We're looking at L-alanine, and this is an L-alanine derivative. So there would have had to have been a reaction that came before this. We would have had to make the ester bond before this. So the ester bond is sitting here. And the ester bond with that alcohol would have had to have been done before this reaction. Likewise, this component here has a phosphate ester. And that phosphate ester would have had to have been made before. So the phosphate ester would have been made by combining, presumably, the trichloro derivative, which is almost like a phosgene or a mustard gas. These are highly dangerous sorts of reagents with the chloride and the phosphorus like this. And they would have had to add that together with the phenol and made this piece before doing this first reaction. And once those two are put together and we have the alanine derivative and we have the phosphate derivative, then we can do a chemical reaction where we bring that L-alanine together with the phosphate in triethylamine with, methylene chloride and triethylamine. So looking at what these reagents are doing, it allows us to explore all sorts of different concepts here that are really kind of cool. Triethylamine, when we look at it, that's what we write, ET3N. This equals 3 ethyl groups on the amine. And this amine is a non-nucleophilic amine. Most amines are nucleophiles. But when we put 3 alkyl groups, and particularly alkyl groups that are fairly bulky, like 3 ethyl groups, makes the amine non-nucleophilic. It means that this amine can only function as a base. If it were to function as a nucleophile, the nucleophile normally binds to, permanently, an electrophile. So if we were to hit something R with a leaving group and the lone pairs come and bind to R, what happens is it produces now a nitrogen that has a positive charge, an ammonium ion, and this is a quaternary ammonium ion. And there is no way to relieve the positive charge. And because of that, this quaternary ammonium also functions as a good leaving group and cannot be deprotonated, cannot relieve the positive charge. And so this reaction, where it acts as a nucleophile, is a completely reversible reaction. And we say that the amine is non-nucleophilic. And so these are oftentimes referred to as sacrificial bases, or a base that is a non-nucleophilic base that is thrown into the chemical reaction to serve the function as only a base. There are a number of different amines that do this sort of job. So another very common base is diisopropyl ethyl amine, which is called Hunnings base. And that is a very common base to use that is non-nucleophilic, that is even more bulky than triethylamine. And then there are some others that are aromatic that also do the same sorts of jobs. So these are all just sacrificial bases. And essentially what's happening there is that the job of the base, and I kind of want to show the reaction at the same time that I'm doing it here. Let's see if I can turn it around. The job of the base is to react with the alanine derivative. And what we're going to do is sort of draw this in a different way. So we'll put the 3 hydrogens on here. And that base takes the proton, giving the electrons back to the nitrogen. And now what I have is a nitrogen nucleophile. That nitrogen nucleophile then reacts with the phosphorus derivative. Binds to the phosphorus, breaks the bond here, kicking electrons up onto the oxygen. The nitrogen is now bound to this. the nitrogen has a positive charge on it initially. The oxygen, the negative. Oops, and I need to make a little bit more room to fit my other phenol in here. And then the lone pairs push back in and push out the better leaving group. The better leaving group in this case is the chloride ion. And as we push out the chloride ion, the last thing that winds up happening to this molecule, as we're almost there, is the deprotonation of the nitrogen. And so that triethylamine comes back in because they use multiple equivalents. It's not just a single equivalent. They're not telling us how much they're using, but they're using multiple equivalents. And without drawing it all over again, I'll just grab this piece. And this is what we're calling part A, or the first synthesis that we've done there. Okay, so that's the first step. Would there be triethylamine be used as the solvent? Triethylamine is not generally used as a solvent. We generally, triethylamine is very, it can be used as a solvent. There's not really a risk of overreaction, but what happens is we tend to use the triethylamine in a smaller amount. A byproduct out of this is the triethylamine hydrochloride. And the solvent that we are using is CH2Cl2, which is not very polar at all, which means that this thing precipitates out as a solid and crashes out in the CH2Cl2 so that I can just filter it off at the end of the chemical reaction, which makes isolation way easier. So I filter that off and then I rotovap it, and I have removed the triethylamine component without having to do some other big workup from this. So we typically don't use the triethylamine as a solvent itself. We typically use a number of equivalents of it inside a different solvent that it will precipitate out from after it has served its function as a base. That also moves the reaction forward by Le Chatelier's principle. Remember that whenever you remove a component, the reaction equilibrium shifts to try to generate more of that component. So if I can either have a component go off as a gas or precipitate out as a solid, that makes the reaction a higher yielding reaction and a much more efficient reaction. And it also makes it more commercially viable by not having to do great big separations. So both things are true. Good question, Eric. Thank you. All right, so we've made part A. Let's grab the next step of the synthesis and look at part B. So in part B, I'm going to grab just this guy. This is part B. This is where we start working on the sugar. So remember that what we're doing here is we're doing a convergent synthesis. So we are working on each of these parts and building each of these parts up, and then we are going to take and react these parts together. So we're making part A, and then we're making part B, and then we're going to make part C, and then we're going to bring A, B, and C together in a bigger synthesis. So a convergent synthesis. And also, I wish they had yields posted on these. I didn't go find the original paper in the synthesis of this, and I should have. What I did is I just went from the various steps that I could find online that wasn't the original paper, but the original paper would have all the percent yields in this, which would be really fun to actually see what these yields are. Okay, so this requires a little bit of explanation. And if you'll forgive me for a second, my iPad is really dark and display brightness. There we go. This is going to make it overheat unhappily, but at least now I can see exactly what I'm doing. This reaction should look a little familiar to you guys, or at least a component of it should, and that's the acetic anhydride that we just used. Acetic anhydride in the synthesis of acetylsalicylic acid. Here it's serving a different purpose. Here, this is an oxidation reaction that we're looking at. And so we're going to see how acetic anhydride can serve to function in different sorts of synthesis. This is a synthesis that is called an Albright-Goldman oxidation. So the name of it is over here. And I had written there in the notes to myself, Swern-like with a question mark. And indeed, when I actually found the reaction and figured out what the reaction mechanism was, it is sort of Swern-like. So Swern is a reaction that we study second semester, and it is a very mild oxidizing conditions. This is also very mild oxidizing conditions. And what we are doing is the transformation that we are seeking to do is to convert the hydroxyl group into a carbonyl, and it's an oxidation of that specific hydroxyl group. And while this looks like an ester, in a cyclic ester sense, this is called a lactone. So lactones are nothing more than cyclic esters. And we are oxidizing the sugar derivative in a functional group that is called a hemiacetal. Into the carbonyl, which is the lactone. And what they have on here are these groups that say BN, and those BNs are protecting groups. Those are benzyl protecting groups. And because the sugar molecule would have three other competing hydroxyls, and each one of those hydroxyls would in turn be oxidized in this chemical reaction, I can't have all three hydroxyl groups present when I want to oxidize just that hemiacetal. So instead, what we do is we put benzyl protecting groups onto each one of these hydroxyl groups before we go and do the chemical reaction. So this would have been derivatized in another reaction with these protecting groups before I moved on. However, those benzyl protecting groups go on in very high yield. Those benzyl protecting groups are SN2 reactions. We'll look at how they're put on. And they're very high yielding reaction steps, and they can be removed in very high yield as well. So the way that a benzyl protecting group is put on and what that group looks like is we take an alcohol that we want to protect and we react it with the benzyl protecting group. Yeah, I'm going to use the dark green. And the benzyl protecting group has a benzene ring, a CH2 group, and then a chlorine. And this could be called BNCl. And the reaction that we do is a reaction that has a base like triethylamine in some solvent, generally not an alcohol solvent, but a solvent appropriate for an SN2 reaction, something like THF, tetrahydrofuran, which is an ether solvent, something like that. And it's inherently an SN2 reaction where the chloride is kicked out by the hydroxyl group. So it's just an SN2 step. And what we generate is a new bond binding to the benzyl group. And we still have the proton that is on here. So the proton is then taken by the base. So whatever base we happen to have in solution takes that proton. And we end up with our benzyl protecting group. And these can be removed by a number of different chemical reactions. And we typically then write these R, O, and then we just write BN. And that's the protecting group that we're seeing there. And that whole thing, actually, we would consider this bond with the oxygen to be part of that protecting group as well, as being on there. So that's what those BNs are that are on there. And then the Swern oxidation, or this Albright-Goldman oxidation, is kind of cool. DMSO is the main solvent that is in this, but the DMSO is also what is really effectively causing the oxidation to happen. So when we look at that DMSO, it's dimethyl sulfoxide. And dimethyl sulfoxide is a 10 electron exception to the octet rule for the sulfur. It's got 10 electrons on the sulfur, which means that if I think about this, that this is also in equilibrium with its resonance contributor, where the sulfur has a formal positive and the oxygen a formal negative. And what that means is that the sulfur is actually a fairly strong electrophile. And being a really strong electrophile, it reacts with the alcohol that we have in solution, where the alcohol binds to the sulfur. And so what we get is the sugar molecule, and I'm going to do it with just an R group for now to make this a little bit easier to follow rather than doing it with a whole big thing. So here is my alcohol that I'm interested in oxidizing, and the alcohol comes in and binds to the sulfur and produces now an additional bond. We'll put the lone pairs over here. We get the O minus. The sulfur, now having four bonds and the lone pair, no longer has a positive charge, but the positive charge has been transferred to the incoming oxygen so that we have the same positives and negative charges in here. A base in solution, the triethylamine that, or actually they don't have it in here, but there must be a base that's in here as well. The base pulls the proton, and I'm then at this neutral, well, not neutral, it's a negatively charged sulfur or negatively charged oxygen on the sulfur. And I'm at this step. This is where now the acetic anhydride comes in. There's a nucleophilic attack by this oxygen on the acetic anhydride, much like we would have seen in our acetylsalicylic acid synthesis. Once I get that new bond forming, I have something very similar to what I had in the acetylsalicylic acid synthesis. Namely, what I have is a good leaving group built into this molecule. And with the good leaving group built into this molecule, what winds up happening here is that a base pulls one of these protons. And as the base comes in and pulls a proton, the electrons kick in to make a double bond with the oxygen. The electrons here go back to the sulfur. The bond breaks here, moving in this direction, and this bond breaks and moves on to the oxygen here. Or we could say that it moves in a cascade to make a double bond and up onto that oxygen there. When this whole thing breaks down, basically what it breaks down into is the R group now has a double bond and the single hydrogen. This is the oxidation step. The sulfur winds up having two electrons on it and two methyl groups, and this is dimethyl sulfide and is a gas, and that gas leaves the reaction vessel. The other component that gets formed is an equivalent of acetate anion, and the other equivalent also becomes an acetate anion. And these, presumably in an aqueous workup, get put out as acetic acid and removed from the reaction vessel. And so the whole thing just breaks down into the oxidation, and I lose dimethyl sulfide and acetic acid. So all of those components that went into that chemical reaction break down in a non-toxic sort of way. And what's really nice about this reaction too is that this is a fairly green environmentally friendly reaction in that it's done under nitrogen at room temperature for 48 hours. I don't have to heat it. I don't have to cool it. It just runs for 48 hours. And that's a very environmentally friendly sort of reaction and a very commercially viable sort of reaction, because you don't have to heat or cool the reaction. It just does its own thing. And we oxidize to that lactone. Okay, that's that part. So at any point, you guys are pretty good about stopping and asking your questions, but let me know if you have questions as we're going along and doing this. And I know that I'm not expecting you. So what is my expectation here? My expectation is not for you to understand all of these reactions or even to understand every part of these reactions. My expectation really is just to give you an appreciation for how difficult a job this is to synthesize a molecule like this, and to talk about some of these other sorts of reactions that we wouldn't see until second semester, but we're getting almost there. We're at the end of this semester, and I don't want to take up lecture time to do it, but when we're ahead in the lab schedule, this is sort of a great place to be able to talk about some of these types of reactions. And this is a perfect reaction that I would allow to be done in a special project sort of sense in second semester. This would be a great reaction to go through and do in special projects in this way. Or even trying to do this by SWERN and doing it as a SWERN oxidation. The only difference between this one and SWERN is that SWERN needs to be done very cold at minus 78 degrees Celsius, whereas this one is being done at room temperature, which makes it kind of cool to look at. All right, let's go grab the next step. The next step is a couple of combined steps here. And this is using a pyrrole derivative. It's a pyrrole triazine 4-amine derivative. And it is reacting with a reagent that is called 1,3-dibromo-5,5-dimethylhydentoin. And they label that DBDMH. So we're looking at this one here, which is the pyrrole triazine 4-amine. So pyrrole is a pyrrolo. Is a six-membered aromatic amine. And I don't know what the rest of that molecule, where that name is coming from, but that's the amine base that we're looking at that is mimicking sort of the DNA or RNA base pair that we're looking at. And this guy here was a new molecule for me. I had never seen this one before. But it's very similar to things that I am familiar with in how it actually works. And so this is a brominating reagent and is probably free radical in nature. I'm not entirely positive, but most of the reactions that are like this are done in a free radical way. We study a reaction like this in second semester where we use a reagent called N-bromosuccinamide. And I think that when we look at this molecule, you'll see the similarities of this is N-bromosuccinamide, or we call it NBS, N-bromosuccinamide. And the molecule, in having the nitrogen bound to two carbonyls with a bromine on the nitrogen, is reflected here in the two carbonyls, the nitrogen, and the bromine on the nitrogen. So this is very much like NBS. And what NBS does in general is that when you shine light on NBS or you hit it with heat, it fragments and breaks down in a free radical reaction where you generate some bromine free radical and this very stable succinamide free radical. The bromine free radical then generally on some R group abstracts a proton in an acid base sense, but in a free radical way. And so you end up with HBr, and you end up with a radical on your carbon. The carbon radical then reacts with another N-bromosuccinamide and pulls the bromide off the N-bromosuccinamide. So you only need to catalytically start the reaction, and then the reaction is a chain reaction in its free radical nature. And so what we end up with is the brominated hydrocarbon and another equivalent of the N-bromo or of the 6-cinamide free radical. And this keeps going in a chain reaction like this until the substrate is entirely brominated. And I think that that is what is occurring here in this step, that we have the proton that was in this location. And for whatever reason, that is the proton that is abstracted by the bromine radical. While there are other protons that are in this molecule, none of these other protons are as acidic as the proton that is in red by virtue of the stability of the free radical. And I haven't gone through and looked at it to say exactly why, but I'm sure it's due to resonance of the free radical, and that if we break it down and we look at all the resonance associated with it, and we haven't done free radical resonance yet, but if we break it down and we look at all the resonance associated with the free radical when the red hydrogen is pulled, I think that we would find that that is the most acidic proton in a free radical reaction. And so that's the one that gets brominated, and it's done in two steps. So you see that we have the first step here, which is the bromination, and then you have the second step, which is using sodium sulfite. And sodium sulfite is a reducing agent, and it destroys any of the remaining DBDMH that is causing this reaction to take place. And so this is really a quench step so that we don't get over bromination. We allow this reaction to warm up from minus 20 degrees, so this is minus 20 degrees C, on to room temperature. And as long as it allows that to take, and then they quench it right away with the sodium sulfate in water, and they isolate out the monobrominated product. I don't know how high yield that reaction is, but it's kind of a cool reaction to think about. And then in a second step, what they do is they do a protection to protect the two protons that are acidic protons. So we have two protons that are here that are on this aniline derivative. And those two protons would be destroyed by the step that is this second step, reacting with N-butyl lithium. So this is the reagent that I was talking about earlier when I talked about tertiary butyl lithium and N-butyl lithium as being very, very strong bases. These two protons that are up here are acidic. And that N-butyl lithium would pull those two protons very quickly if we didn't get rid of them and protect them. And so the first step here is a protection step where we are putting a protecting group, a TMS protecting group, a trimethyl silyl protecting group, in place of those two nitrogens before we go through and do what's called a lithium halogen exchange reaction. So those protecting groups are, let me show you what those look like. TMSCl is a trimethyl silyl chloride. And this is used as a protecting group for alcohols and for amines. And here they're using it for the amine. And the way that this reaction works is that if we take the amine as the primary amine, as we have it, and our trimethyl silyl chloride, that this is an SN2 reaction where the amine just binds to the silicon and we still have two protons on here, becomes positively charged, and then some sacrificial base takes the proton and we get the silicon and the lone pairs, and this is called the TMS group, trimethyl silyl group. So I think I want to put the hydrogen down there. So one of the things that we saw was that when we put the benzyl protecting group onto those other oxygens, the benzyl protecting group, just to remind you, had the chloride group on it, and we had the alcohol that was attacking the chloride and doing an SN2 step. Most protecting groups, when we put them on, are SN2 steps. And when we remove them, many of the times when we remove them, they are also SN2 steps. And that SN2 reactions are one of the fundamental basic reactions and are very high yielding reactions for the most part, and are utilized all the time throughout even some of these common steps. And within biological chemistry, you will find SN2 steps within biological chemistry quite frequently as well, which is kind of cool to think about. Okay, so we're seeing some similarities here in the way that these reactions are moving forward. And there was something else that I wanted to put here too. Remember that SN2 steps work best primary, and then primary or fastest, then secondary, then tertiary. This is sort of a primary benzyl in the way that I look at the CH2 group there, but the silicon is not. The silicon is really sort of tertiary. But remember too that what happens is as we go down from carbon to silicon to whatever comes down below silicon, that as I increase or go down in the periodic table, that I increase in size, which means that a carbon is a whole lot smaller than a silicon. Silicon is a lot larger. The larger size of the silicon means that it's easier for the SN2 reaction to take place. So even though this is a tertiary substrate, it's tertiary on silicon, which is really large and still very active for SN2 reactions. So I just wanted to hit that point really quick. So what they do is they put those TMS groups on, and then they do what's called, this step is called a lithium halogen exchange. Let me grab that much of the reaction because now it's too cluttered up here. Let's take it down here and look at this lithium halogen exchange reaction. The mechanism of a lithium halogen exchange is not well understood. And this is one of the things that sometimes is challenging. I have, from my teaching standpoint, because I've spent so much time pounding mechanisms and saying that mechanisms are the most important thing, that if you understand the fundamental reaction, how the reaction moves forward, then you have control over the reaction. And that is absolutely true. However, many of the reactions in organic chemistry that we use all the time, we don't well understand the mode of action. We know what it's doing. We know the reaction from its starting point to its ending point and what the product is. And we know the conditions that will make that reaction happen. But we don't always understand exactly how the reaction takes place. And there are some theories about how this reaction takes place, none of which I have studied in great detail. But that's okay. Sometimes we have limits to our understanding and our models, and we do the best that we can. And some reactions within organic chemistry, we just use and we just memorize without actually knowing what the reaction mechanism is. This is one of them. But what's cool about this reaction is something else. If we look at what's actually happening here and the polarity of the original bond, the bromide over here is partial minus and the carbon is partial positive. And in the product, when we exchange the bromide for the lithium is now a cation and presumably the carbon is an anion. We have switched the polarity and we have created a carbanion from a halogen. This is done in numerous different ways with numerous different materials. The Grignard is one of the things that come to mind, that it is very typical to take and take a halogen, an alkyl halogen, such as a bromide, and to react it with magnesium metal. But this is the metal itself, and the metal inserts by one of two modes, either free radical or stepwise, into this bond. And what winds up happening is the metal goes to a 2+, the bromide is a negative, and the R group is a negative, and this becomes a carbanion. Where we had partial positive and partial minus, now what I have is a carbanion. And this type of reaction is what's called an umpelung. Umpelung? I think that's the right way to spell it. U-M-P-O-L-U-N-G. L-O-N-G. And basically what that means is a reversal of polarity. It's a really cool type of reaction where we take what was essentially an electrophile and turn it into a nucleophile. And this becomes a nucleophile. And that's what's been done here in this lithium halogen exchange, is that we've created a really good nucleophile. So this guy is now our nucleophile and ready and set up to react with our carbonyl compound that we made that was part B, I think it was. So where we made the carbonyl just up here, we're going to take that new carbanion and we're going to react it with this carbonyl compound in short order in that convergent synthesis sort of way. So let's move to that step and look at that next step and how we bring those together. So that is this piece here. So what we do is we take molecule B and molecule C, and this is our electrophile and our nucleophile. And we bring these together under an inert atmosphere. I didn't see what solvent they were doing it in, but usually this is done in a solvent like THF. And then there's an acidic workup at the end of this reaction. And essentially what is happening here is that the negative charge that is on this carbon is attacking this carbonyl, breaking the bond, and shifting the electrons up onto the oxygen. The acidic workup that follows is to protonate the developing carbanion to provide that proton. And so we make the bond, which is the new bond that we have made here. And because the carbonyl is a flat planar functional group, we can get equal attack from above or from below of the carbonyl. So when we look at the carbonyl, essentially what's happening is that incoming nucleophile can approach from the above position, or the nucleophile can approach from below. And what that does is it sets up a condition where this stereocenter is racemic at that stereocenter. The stereocenter is both up and down. And the problem is that I already have three other defined stereocenters. So because there are three other defined stereocenters, this is a one-to-one mixture of diastereomers. And I didn't include this morning, but I have this word here that was in my personal notes for putting this together that says anomers, one-to-one mixture of anomers. An anomer is something that we use for sugars. It's a way that we describe a specific stereocenter on a sugar molecule as an anomer. And it happens where we have hemiketals or hemiacetals. And it's that on a sugar molecule, where there are two oxygens connected to the same carbon, this carbon is called the anomeric carbon. And the two sugar isomers that are in equilibrium are called anomers because they differ at the anomeric carbon. So these are anomers. And anomers, in this sense, when there are other stereocenters present, such as there are on ribose, those anomers are technically diastereomers. And so they can be referred to as enomers, but they can also be referred to as diastereomers. And so what I get is a one-to-one mixture of diastereomers, and we are going to have to throw away 50% of that reaction at a certain point, because we need to take forward only one of those diastereomers, not both of them. So at some point here, we're going to lose 50% of what we just put together, because we can only have one of those diastereomers move forward in this reaction sequence. Okay, so we've made these two diastereomers. Let's move forward and look at the next step of what we do with those. So that next step is this reaction, which I have in a vertical sense, unfortunately. So we'll take this piece here. And let's see if we can turn this around and make it not vertical. Make it horizontal. So these are all my reagents. And my chemical reaction. So three steps in order to get to this next product. And if we look and see what's actually happening here, really what's happening is that we lost the TMS groups. So what was the protecting group here that was the TMS? We removed the protecting group, and what did that was the acidic workup. The acidic workup busted that protecting group off and removed the protecting group. Let's say it this way. But it didn't remove the benzyl groups. Okay, so now what we have is we're doing a reaction here where our entire goal is to change out this hydroxyl group for the cyano group. And we're bringing in the cyano group. How would these be separated? Eric, I'm going to get to that in a minute. So they're separated. I'll get to that point where we actually separate them and I'll show you. They're not as hard to separate as you would think, because they're actually not enantiomers. They're diastereomers. So because they're diastereomers, remember that diastereomers are completely different compounds. They have different boiling points, they have different melting points, they have different polarities. And because they have different polarities, they can be separated by simple chromatography methods. So column chromatography or HPLC or TLC, all of those different types of chromatography can separate these out. And I think that what they do here is they do HPLC. We'll see in a few minutes, but they're separated just based on chromatography because they have differences in their polarities. So this reaction turns out to be a little bit harder of a reaction to explain. And I don't know that I entirely understand what is happening in this reaction, but I want to look at a couple of the reagents that are here and a part of what they are doing. The TMSCN. This is the trimethyl silo with a cyano group on it. And the TMSOTF is a TMS group, trimethyl silo, bound to an oxygen that has an aromatic ring and a CF3 group on it. These are normal sorts of protecting groups. The trimethyl silyl is a protecting group, and the OTF, which is called a triflate, so this piece is called a triflate, is a really good leaving group. This is a super good leaving group. And it's usually used when I want to turn a poor leaving group into a good leaving group. and it's generally used for alcohols. So what we normally do is we take an alcohol and we react the alcohol I know what I'm missing here. I'm drawing this in the wrong way. Let me fix this. This should be, and I made that mistake in the notes this morning. I'll have to go back and correct the notes from this morning. I knew I was missing something when I drew that this morning. That's the triflate. And so what we normally react this with is TFCl, which is the reagent that these are generally made from that have the chloride in them to make them good electrophiles. And what we get is we get the ROS and the CF3 group. And this group, we generally just write ROTF, and that's the triflate. And it turns this entire group into a really good leaving group for the purpose of SN2 reactions. So this is basically setting up a super good leaving group for an SN2 reaction. So somewhere in here, by bringing in the TMSCN and bringing in the TMSOTF, I believe that what they are doing is they are taking this piece and converting this piece through a sequence of reactions into, number one, getting a really good leaving group on this. And like I said, I haven't worked out the entire reaction mechanism, but I think that what they are doing is converting this into the triflate. And then after it's converted into the triflate, the cyano group, which was somehow liberated in the reaction process, is doing an SN2 reaction and kicking this guy out. Which is now bringing in the CN group, the cyano group. And so it's a sequence of reactions that are doing this, and we're still getting a one-to-one mixture of anomers. So we're still racemic at this stereocenter, and this is still a wiggly bond, which is up and down at that stereocenter. Then they go through, and after they put that cyano group on there, they go through and do the resolution. Oh, they don't? Yeah, they do the resolution, but it's... it's after they remove the protecting groups. So we're going to remove the protecting groups first. And I know my reaction is now going in reverse, but we're going to have to deal with that. Or maybe not. I keep forgetting that I'm on a tablet where I can slide everything around. And like magic. That's cool. Okay, so what we're doing here is removing the protecting groups. And this reaction is a nice, cool little reaction too. They're using BCl3 in DCM. DCM stands for dichloromethane. So dichloromethane is CH2Cl2, methylene chloride. Same reagent, same solvent that we use quite a bit in our labs. And what the BCl3 is doing is BCl3 is a source of chloride minus. It liberates chloride minus by the oxygens binding to the boron and then the boron releasing a chloride minus ion. And once that chloride minus ion is there, the boron is also serving as a Lewis acid function. But essentially what's happening is if I take these benzyl protecting groups, the benzyl protecting groups are great SN2 reaction substances. And so I'm basically kicking this guy off with a chloride and removing the protecting group. So it's just a protecting group removal step, is all that really is. And so I remove all of the benzyl groups. So each one of these protecting groups is being removed. And once they're removed, then I go through and I do reverse phase HPLC. This is the chromatography step. The chromatography step is able to separate the anomers into single isomer. And so this is essentially a 50% yield step. And I throw away 50% of the molecule that is the wrong isomer, which is a devastating step to have to go through. And it would be nice if I could do this in a stereoselective sort of reaction where I could produce just the enantiomer that I want or just the diastereomer that I want without producing the other one. But I don't think that they have that yet. So this is the way that they have to do it. They have to throw away 50% of that product. And the reverse phase HPLC is very much like what we talked about with the isolation of caffeine. When we talked about reverse phase chromatography in the isolation of the caffeine, and we said that we took silica gel and impregnated it with C18 in order to make it nonpolar. Well, this is a nonpolar packing material, probably very similar to the C18 bound on silica gel. And then they're doing HPLC, and HPLC stands for high pressure liquid chromatography, or sometimes high performance liquid chromatography. Depends upon who you talk to. So high pressure liquid chromatography. And it's very much like when we do column chromatography and we have the column that we pass the material through and we put some pressure onto this thing and then separate it out into test tubes. It's very much like that, only what we do is we have a steel tube and the packing material is placed into this steel tube. And the steel tube then is sealed up. And so it's got really big nuts that go on the end of this thing and a very small little tube that goes through it and a motor that pumps liquid through this at very high pressures. And then it goes through some detector. The detector is probably something similar to an IR instrument, only it's an array of light sources that are detecting at different frequencies, and they can tell when compounds are coming through, and then you can switch the places where you're acquiring the sample as the sample is being eluted off the column. So it's just done under very high pressure, and that makes it perform extraordinarily fast and extraordinarily well, and you can do this in a large batch that goes through. So they use reverse phase high performance liquid chromatography. However, this is expensive. So when they're trying to scale this up and make this, anytime you have to do a chromatography step or a resolution step like this, it makes it not as commercially viable, and this makes this reaction and this product a much more expensive product than it would be otherwise if you have to go through and do something like this. Okay, so we've got this single isomer Then the next step that we do is to bring the two big components together into our last step, essentially. So we've just got this one last step to go. Actually, I'm going to grab this whole page because that's easier. Okay, so now in this last step, what we're doing is we're taking these two halves of the molecules that we've made, and we're bringing them together to actually make the remdesivir. So I want to get rid of this arrow, and I want to take these two reagents, I'm going to place them over on the side. And this is sort of a downwards reaction rather than a sideways reaction because everything's getting really big. And what we're doing here is we're reacting this hydroxyl group and the phosphate, and the chloride is our leaving group. So we're bringing these two together. This material is our solvent. Presumably, this is a phosphate ester solvent, which provides good solubility for these. I've never seen this solvent used before in this way, but that's the solvent. And then this thing is another base like triethylamine. It's a non-nucleophilic base. And so when we bring these two together and join these two together, the byproduct out of this is going to be that base taking the chlorine and forming the salt. So we'll get the proton here, the positive charge, and the chloride anion. And this thing is going to be a solid and it's going to precipitate out. And we make, again, a mixture of diastereomers here. And the mixture of diastereomers has to do with the fact that that phosphorus is chiral. And this is the last stereocenter. All the other stereocenters are set. And this is a one-to-one mixture in diastereomers. And so we're going to go through and do a resolution. This resolution is much the same as what we've done or what we showed before when we did our stereochemical chapter. And we looked at doing resolutions using things like tartaric acid with different amines. Well, we have many different amine functional groups on here, and I don't know, they didn't say what they did to make this resolution happen, but they're doing a resolution where they're separating out these mixtures, this one-to-one mixture of diastereomers, and again, this is a 50% yield step. Because the other stereoisomer can't be used and hasn't been shown to be non-harmful or productive. And so they need to do that resolution and throw 50% of that away as well. So that's the overall reaction that's happening there and the number of steps that they need to do to actually bring that together. So I haven't actually counted the steps when you bring in all the protection and deprotection steps. But it's convergent in three different steps. And two of those convergent steps have resolutions that mean that you knock it down by 50%. And there's another good number of protection and deprotection steps. This thing probably has about 10 or 15 steps overall. Eric, how is that one ROH rough isolated for the reaction? Oh, because there's other ROHs that are in there. That's a great question. These hydroxyl groups here, this is a secondary. This is a secondary. This one is a primary. And in an SN2 reaction, the primary has much less sterics around it than do the secondaries. And so it's being selective for the primary due to sterics. There's just way more sterics that are involved in these guys. And so these guys are shut down based on sterics. And this one has a higher reaction rate. Due to less sterics. However, that doesn't mean that the other two don't react. So that's a great question too, in that this reaction that produces this mixture of diastereomers is probably only, I would guess, maybe a 60% yield at best, because you're going to get 40% where it's reacting with the other hydroxyl groups. And so to an extent, this thing is probably not even as good as we're making it look here, even though we've got the 50% resolution step. It's probably even worse than that. But that's how they're going through and doing that, is that they're using the primary hydroxyl in order to put this together. They could go through and protect the primary and then protect the secondaries with a different protecting group, remove the primary protecting group, then do the reaction at a higher yield, and then deprotect the secondaries. But the added three steps would decrease the yield probably below what they're getting in the selectivity by just going with the unprotected and going for the primary. And they probably looked at that and made that decision to go through and do it this way, because it was probably a better yield doing it this way than trying to selectively protect and deprotect all those hydroxyl groups. So that's a really good question too. So six stereocenters. And when looking at these six stereocenters, if you remember from our stereochemical chapter, that the number of possible isomers is 2 to the n, where n equals the number of stereocenters. So that's going to be 2 to the 6th, which means, what do we got? 64 possible isomers. And we've made a single isomer out of the 64 different possibilities, and that is the remdesivir drug. And all the stereochemical assignments, if I did those correctly, you can go through and you can see if you can assign the different stereochemical centers and see what you come out with. But out of the 64 different possible isomers, they make just that single isomer, and that is remdesivir. How many different resolution steps were performed? Two resolution steps. One that they're calling a resolution, and one that they're calling chromatography. But they just had resolution written. They didn't say how it was resolved. It could have been resolved by HPLC, and I don't know. But anytime you have to do an HPLC step like that, or a resolution step, that's an expensive step where you're throwing away 50% of the molecule. So I just think that it's interesting to look at this molecule and to think about what it's going to take to ramp up synthesis of this molecule to be able to treat the number of people that they want to treat in a pandemic, and how complicated a molecule can be, in that when we're looking at organic chemistry, we keep looking at these small little steps and individual reactions, SN2, SN1, E2, E1, and thinking about them as isolated steps and on small molecules. How do we do this on a large molecule and show you the complexity of what is organic chemistry? To me, I just think this is just the coolest thing ever, to look at how do you make a really big drug like this, and what does it take, and what are all of the factors that go into it, into what makes it commercially viable or possible, and what is the actual yield that you can get out of this, and how expensive is it to make a drug like this and to scale that thing up so that you have a factory that is designed just to produce this drug. And some of these steps cannot be done in huge batches. Some of these steps have to be done in smaller batches. Like, you can only HPLC so much material, which means that they probably have, I don't know how many HPLC machines that are running to resolve this thing, but it's probably got to be in the hundreds of different HPLC columns that are running these batches through and isolating out these compounds to take forward. And how do you actually go through and scale that up? And that's That's the process of a chemical engineer, that a chemical engineer takes a chemical reaction and designs a plant to be able to do that on large scale. And they have to take into account what are all the heat conditions, how toxic are these materials, how corrosive are these materials in terms of the materials that you can use to contain them. Because no longer are you using glass reaction vessels, but now we're using stainless steel or some other materials as vats to be able to contain these types of materials. And how do you move them around in a plant from place to place, controlling the heat, controlling the energy, and recycling the solvents if you can, and all of that stuff that goes into it is just an enormous sort of undertaking, and something that's pretty cool to think about. Anyway, that's what I had for you guys for today, was just to look at remdesivir and to see what kind of goes into a bigger drug like that. And in a second semester sort of special project way, like I said, that we would normally think about undertaking, maybe let me switch back to this guy where I had the beginning steps, maybe looking at just doing the first or second of these steps in like this reaction here, putting the benzyl protecting groups on. And actually going through and doing this reaction, putting the benzyl protecting groups on, doing the oxidation reaction, and then maybe trying to react it with an amine or some other nucleophile to show proof of concept would be a great second semester type of project, because it's not just a single step. You got to get the benzyl protecting groups on there. We have to verify that they're on there. We have to show that they didn't go on to the hemiacetal component. And then we have to go through and do the oxidation step and prove that we've done the oxidation step. And this is a perfect sort of second semester type of project where, even though we're not synthesizing the entire molecule, because there's no way we could possibly do that, we can take a step or two given commercially viable products and do one or two steps of the transformation, or three steps in the transformation. It's very hard to get three steps. Four is darn near impossible. Two to three is what I like to try to shoot for in a special project sense. But so if we can't find a product that we can make in two or three steps and get to the end goal, then what we do is we take a larger drug or something like that, and we look at, well, what can we do from just the beginning, first, second, third steps out of that, or some sequence within it that we could pick up in the middle, as long as the materials are commercially available and we can buy those materials, and then we can look at doing that intermediate step. So that's a little bit about what special projects kind of look like a little bit. And all the other stuff that we talked about, and a bunch of SN2 steps that are in here. So I hope that was interesting. I hope I didn't just bore the crap out of you. Like I said, my goal was really just to show you a bunch of new things and to show you in context and to make the organic chemistry a little bit more interesting by showing you the context and in the light of current events. Makes it all the more interesting. All right. How about any questions? No? Stunned silence. Stunned disbelief. All right. I have nothing to assign for you today. This was all just for fun. And let's call it good. And if you have any questions and you want to stay on the line, I'm happy to do any questions individually if you want to stay on. And other than that, let's call it an afternoon, and I'll get this up and online and posted. And the lecture is already posted. So if any of you want to go back and review the lecture content from today, because I know that that was a fairly dense lecture from today, all that is already up for you and online. Okay? Thanks, Galen.
Thanks, Jason.
Hey, you're welcome. Wednesday. All right. Take care. I'll see you guys Wednesday.